Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deep dive into the issues that you care about with guests that you would like to hear from. And this week, when Wisconsin added voter ID as a requirement to the state constitution with a ballot measure getting overwhelming support, this was encouraging in the midst of course, Wisconsin losing that Supreme Court seat and not obtaining a conservative balance. So a little bit of a split there in Wisconsin, but at least Florida did keep the two congressional seats as Republicans. So that shift of the majority will not change, at least in Congress. But what does this voter ID requirement actually do to promote election integrity? And where are we at now, 5 years after the 2020 election, which is absolutely crazy? It's already been that long. But joining me to discuss all of this and more and where we need to go is Cleta Mitchell, who's with the Conservative Partnership Institute and was one of Trump's lawyers during the 2020 election. And she's been very much in the midst of all of the election integrity challenges and what we should be doing overall for this really important issue to keep elections free and fair. So, Cleta, thank you so much for joining me on demand.
Well, it's great to be with you, Jenna, as always.
Thank you. So let's start in Wisconsin with this voter ID requirement. What does this actually do? And it sounds like a great thing. And will this help add to the free and fair elections in Wisconsin, which, of course, has been a swing state for sure over the last several presidential cycles?
Well, a lot to unpack here. Let's just start with the fact that requiring a photo ID for voting is very popular with the American people, regardless of political party or ideology. Literally, the only people who oppose voter ID are elites in the Democratic Party, about 20% of the people in the country. 80% plus of the Americans believe that you should have to present a photo ID when you vote. And the legislature in Wisconsin, the Republican legislature, had passed it, and it was vetoed by the Democratic governor. So the legislature decided to put it into the state constitution, and they can do that by passing in two successive legislative sessions, and it goes directly to the ballot, voted on by the people, and then you don't have to deal with the Democrat governor who is controlled by the left. So that's all great, and it was enacted overwhelmingly yesterday, as it has been in any state where it has been put on the ballot. Now, the devil is in the details, and one of the things that's going to be really important is what will count as a voter ID, because one of the things that I've learned over the last 4 years since 2020, since I've been doing election integrity full-time since 2020, one of the things I've learned is that federal law allows for all kinds of things to be counted as a voter ID that really shouldn't be counted, like a utility bill or a bank statement. And so what we're going to be working on, when I say we, I'm talking about election integrity volunteers from across the country who are part of the Election Integrity Network. And we have put together over the course of, you know, in the last, between the November election and January of this year, we put together what's called what we're calling the U.S. Citizens Elections Bill of Rights. And I'll tell you in a little bit where to find that. And one of the principles is to have voter ID. But make sure that the voter ID, and this is going to be the challenge for the Wisconsin legislature, is to define what will be accepted as an ID for voting purposes. Number one, there really are four principles. Number one, it should be an identification that is issued solely to residents of the state who are citizens of the United States. Let's start with that, which means that certain kinds of IDs would not qualify. A real ID, for instance, is issued to non-citizens. So we have to make certain that if you are using an ID for voting, it's one that is issued only to citizens. It says clearly on the face of it that it is that you, the bearer, is a citizen. That there is a photograph of the person who carries it. And as I said, it issued only to citizens of the United States who are residents of the state, and that it has those components, the photo and it, of the bearer, and it clearly denotes that the person is a U.S. citizen. Because what's happening all over the country now is even in states where there is a voter ID requirement, like North Carolina, well, actually, all but five states allow the use of student IDs and for voting, and the only problem with that is that you do not have to be a resident of the state or a citizen of the United States to get a student ID. Foreign students get the same student IDs. So we've got a lot of cleanup to do to tighten up so that we make sure that the ID that's allowed for voting purposes really is meaningful and restricts the voting to residents and to U.S. citizens. But it's a good step to have the requirement in the Constitution, and it's a good step to have those requirements. We just have to make sure that they are actually meaningful.
Yes, and that totally makes sense. And as someone who went to law school out of state, that totally makes sense that I couldn't just use a student ID when my driver's license ID was still showing that I was a resident of my home state and just there for school. And that's true for a lot of students. And, you know, you mentioned, Cleta, at the outset, you know, the only people that are objecting to these types of common sense requirements are people who want to undermine elections. And that's just so obvious, because keeping elections safe and secure, and only the people who actually meet the requirements voting in elections, keeps things free and fair. And we have that in all other kinds of contexts. Like, you have to have the appropriate identification to board an airplane or a cruise ship, or even, you know, go into a rated R movie, I mean, or buy alcohol or cigarettes. I mean, all kinds of things require a specific type of ID. And yet when it comes to voting, somehow this is so completely lax, and the Democrats will cry foul and disenfranchisement as if the requirement to prove that you can access the franchise is somehow in itself disenfranchisement. That never made sense to me.
Well, yeah, you know, they object to everything. Again, it's like the, who was it who said on, Scott Worthington on CNN, but the whole, it seems that the elites in the Democratic Party are intent upon embracing issues or and opposing issues that where 20% of the American people agree with them and 80% of the American people oppose them. I can give you, we did some polling with Scott Rasmussen earlier this year on a number of election integrity issues, and ensuring that only citizens vote, that's like 87% of the American people agree with that. Requiring a photo ID for voting, again, 85% of the people support that. Requiring that the states clean their voter lists and keep only eligible registrants on the voter list, again, 85% of people support that. Requiring all ballots to be in by the time the polls close on election day, regardless of the source, that in person, by mail, overseas, all ballots, if you come in, if it comes in after election day, it can't count. That, again, that is an 84, 85% issue. And you go down the list of all of the things that the president has talked about that he supports for reforming our elections, and things that we as election integrity leaders and activists have been engaged in, the people are with us. And voter ID is one of them, but it's not the only principle. And 84, 85, 87% of the American people on all these issues, they're with us. But the people we have to fight are the Democrat left-wing media and the Democrat elites and Democrat judges. That's who we have to fight. It's the same people we have to fight on every issue, whether it's transgenders, whether it's men and women sports, whether whatever it is. I mean, it's there is a, there are these elites, these left-wing, and they think differently. And actually, Scott Rasmussen has done, you should have him on sometime if you haven't, to talk about the elites that he has identified, he began to realize that there were differences in how these elite, what he calls the elites, how they think and how the rest of the American people think. And he actually started doing some polling and demographic study and realized that if you take people, for the most part, it's not 100%, who have post-college education, so not just a bachelor's degree, but postgraduate education, they make over $100,000 a year and they live in an urban or suburban area. If you take those three components, that constitutes what he calls the elites, and they think differently than all the rest of us. The problem is, who are you describing there? You're describing judges. You're describing the media, the dominant media. Well, I don't think they're dominant anymore, but certainly they have been for decades. And you're describing the people who control the Democratic Party. So that's who we fight. That's who we have to fight on all these election integrity issues, the same people that we have to fight on every issue. But he's at least he's actually quantified. It's very interesting.
That is really fascinating. And it's also really discouraging, maybe, that we do have to fight all these different activists on the other side. And while we advocate for election integrity, we certainly are advocating for the rule of law, not just a preferred outcome, which is why this issue in particular should be nonpartisan. And if we truly want free and fair elections, it should not be that we are looking for rules that benefit just one side or another. And that's what I find really frustrating about these activists on the other side. So overall, Cleta Mitchell, where are we at with election integrity? And I feel like in some sense, because President Trump got reelected and he's now back in office, there's not nearly as much public scrutiny on election integrity as there was during the four previous years. And I hope that this issue doesn't just fall by the wayside and kind of go back to a status quo, because even before the 2020 election, there were a lot of efforts for the past few decades on election integrity. And so this is something that people like you and others who are advocates for the rule of law and free and fair elections have been pushing for a really long time.
Well, that's true, but I will tell you what's interesting is, and as you say, I've been toiling in this vineyard for many decades in election law, and what has been gratifying to me is the number of people who have become engaged in the effort, who have become experts on how elections operate in their states. They know what the laws are. They know what needs to be changed. And that's really what gave rise to this U.S. Citizens Elections Bill of Rights. I ask election volunteers and activists from around the country, you know, what? Now we've spent 4 years studying all of this. What do we need to do to make things permanent? What do we need to change? And I have all these spreadsheets of things that people sent in, and we took that and organized them by category, and we have 10 principles, and you can find those at www.votefair2026.com. That's votefair2026.com, and it's 10 principles that are necessary to enshrine in law. And those are the things we're going to be working toward. And what's interesting is that following the 2024 election, I thought a lot of the volunteers and leaders would say, okay, we're done, and, you know, President Trump won. But not so. Everyone knows that it's a miracle that Donald Trump was elected, because our laws are still pretty porous, as I mentioned with student IDs. The number of non-citizens who are on our voter rolls are a mess. We have all kinds of problems in our elections that we're going to have to change back to common sense. And as you say, Jenna, having elections that are an election system that is fair to all candidates, where the election administrators are not out trying to get certain groups of voters to vote, but they're running, but instead focusing on making sure their voter rolls are clean and that they run the elections in a transparent manner so that there are observers from both parties and things are one of our leaders said the only thing that should be a secret in elections is who someone votes for. Everything else should be transparent and there should be accountability. And so we know that there's a lot to do. And in that regard, President Trump issued an executive order last week that specifically addresses a number of issues, starting with the number one principle that only U.S. citizens should be voting in our elections. And we have a bill that was passed by the House last year, a piece of legislation that would Congress would overrule a Supreme Court decision from 12 years ago saying that states could not ask for documentary proof of citizenship based on a federal statute. And it would amend that federal statute to say, oh, yes, not only can they ask, they must ask. You must obtain documentary proof of citizenship in order to register to vote in a U.S. election. And the president issued an executive order. That's the SAVE Act, by the way. The name of that bill is the SAVE Act. It was supposed to be on the floor tomorrow, but because of a little hissy fit that the Democrats and nine Republicans, including led by Anna Paulina Luna, short for lunatic. I mean, I'm so angry because of her wanting to be able to vote proxy and not in person, which is something we don't favor election integrity. People don't favor to have non-in-person voting, particularly not for a member of Congress. Anyway, so now that the rest of the votes for this week were canceled, so the SAVE Act is not going to be voted on this week, unfortunately. But the president issued an executive order last week that requires that the citizenship data and other data from federal databases must be used to be compared to the voter rolls of the states to identify non-citizens who are on the voter rolls of every state and to make sure that those are removed before we have another federal election, which is November of 2026. It's a doge for voter rolls, and that would go a long way toward restoring integrity to the elections in every state. And there are also some other provisions in the president's executive order. Obviously, I would love to see all of that codified. But one of the things is saying that in a federal election, that ballots that come in after election day cannot be counted. There is a case that was brought by Judicial Watch that was challenging the law in Mississippi that allows votes to be counted if they come in within 5 days of the election. Judicial Watch challenged that, and the Fifth Circuit ruled that under the federal statute that says that election day is the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November, that indeed ballots that come in after that date cannot be counted. And the Fifth Circuit en banc just affirmed that last week and issued the mandate so that, and I understand the state of Mississippi is going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court, but this is a giant step forward for that principle that election day in federal law means what it says. And that would be terrific if we could get a Supreme Court affirming that Fifth Circuit decision. So, but it's in the president's executive order that he issued. It has several principles in that executive order. One of the principles has to do with ensuring that only citizens are voting and on our voter rolls. One of the provisions of the executive order has to do with making sure that the states are cleaning their voter rolls and that the federal government will assist in making sure that that happens by sharing data with the states at no cost. And one is making sure that ballots are in by election day in order to be counted. Another provision of that executive order is an order to the Election Assistance Commission to review the standards for certifying election equipment and voting machines and voting systems to make certain that they are not susceptible to being hacked or manipulated from it remotely, and to add to the EAC's voluntary voting system guidelines additional provisions that secure and make certain that you don't have foreign interference or any kind of nefarious incursions into the voting process and the voting system using the voting machines. And so these are all issues that we know that the left will litigate, but I feel certain that every provision that is included in this executive order is based on existing federal law, and I'm hopeful that once we get past the forum shopping with trying to find left-wing judges who will agree with the left-wing plaintiffs, that this will all be upheld. So we're making big progress. We've learned a lot over the last 4 years. Now we're in implementation phase. I call this Election Integrity 2.0. 1.0 was the last 4 years, starting 2025. Okay, now we know what we need to do. Now let's do it. That's Election Integrity 2.0.
And that is so important as well, because, as we've all learned with a lot of the breaches and the questions in security and in ensuring that we actually have election integrity measures that just keep everything safe. I mean, it's always, again, it's been a question to say we can secure banking apps and have the transmission of, you know, billions of dollars that go electronically, and all of those are secure. They have audits, there's paper trails, there's all of this stuff. But then when we're talking about voting electronically, then somehow that information is shrouded in this cloud of mystery. And I think as Justice Thomas actually put that in one of his, in one of the dissents to the Texas versus Pennsylvania case, that was really interesting and true. But, but this raises the question of also, Cleta, of obtaining that kind of data early on enough that if there are challenges to the outcomes of elections or people who maybe have voted in an election when they weren't actually qualified, you know, all of these things that we've discussed, part of the issue with these challenges is that it becomes, it historically has been so hard for the candidates to obtain the election information and the audits and the paper trails and all of that in time to make these types of timely challenges. Where are we at with some of those questions?
Well, I think, you know, you raise very important points. Every state has election challenge, election contest procedures, and it's a very truncated period of time. You're not supposed to be able to bring challenges after a certain really within days and weeks after certification of an election. And I know President Trump had trouble in 2020 in many states. Many courts found the president and his campaign didn't have standing. So standing is a huge issue, and mainly because there are two sets of rules on standing. If you're a left-wing organization or a Democrat, you have standing. If you're a conservative Republican, you don't have standing. And that needs to be resolved. And there are a couple of cases on their way to the Supreme Court, hopefully, on that issue. But we really need to settle the reality of two sets of rules. And again, it comes back to these elites who happen to be judges who don't want to hear cases brought by, I would say, our side, and they're more than happy to hear cases. Just look at all these nationwide injunctions that are being issued. Why do these left-wing groups have standing, for goodness sake? And so standing is an issue. Immediate access to data about the election to be able to establish if there's a problem. That was certainly an issue in the case that we brought in Georgia after the 2020 election on behalf of President Trump, because the Secretary of State kept saying, well, your data is wrong. And we kept saying, well, if you have data that we'll bring our data and compare to your data and we'll sort it out. We never got a judge appointed. So we tried to get him to sit down with us to say, you know, if our data is wrong, then we'll say that. But if your data is wrong, you need to do something, because that means that there are more illegal votes than the margin between President Trump and Joe Biden. But just getting, as you say, getting access to the data. But that's why we have to have transparency and we have to have accountability, and it has to be fast, and people have to be able to see for themselves all the records, all the data, to make certain that they can have confidence that the election was honest, lawful, and that the results are accurate. Because that's really all people want. They want to know that the results are accurate.
Yeah, and that is a very basic, again, nonpartisan thing. And we want to ensure that that not only is election integrity upheld, but also that we aren't being disenfranchised in other ways, like what Colorado was trying to do, for example, to get President Trump kicked off the ballot. I mean, even before we talk about voting integrity, we're talking then about just access to the ballot. And we're seeing this phenomenon now, I think, being raised more globally when we see things like Marine Le Pen now, who is the only part of the order that's enforced following her conviction is that she can't run for office for 5 years. With a lot of world leaders saying, you know, this smacks of what President Trump went through. And so I think with everything that he did go through, that has raised more awareness overall to this issue of election integrity, even beyond the United States. And so, you know, for even, you know, elections outside of America, I mean, this is something that affects nations and affects more than just the United States. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on that outcome? Because, you know, my response, of course, was to say that this is exactly why our U.S. Constitution doesn't require a candidate for president to be kicked off the ballot if there's a conviction, because that can be manipulated, that can be lawfare, that can be a partisan judge. I mean, all kinds of things can happen. And so we need to have very standardized, very, very nonpartisan measures, like attaining the age of 35. I mean, that's not something that a judge has any control over. Even with the left wanting people to identify however they want, we still in this country say you can't just identify whatever age you want. Maybe you can your gender. But, you know, some of those things that are just absolutely not given to some kind of partisan interpretation. But that appears to be what's happening in France is exactly what Colorado was trying to do here in America.
Well, this is the same thing has happened in Brazil. I mean, and look at who is being victimized by this. It's the leading candidate. It's the leading opposition candidate to the incumbent in power. It's exactly the same pattern as what happened to President Trump. It's exactly the same group of supporters. It's what would be the equivalent of the MAGA supporters in France and in Brazil. I mean, it is, and it is what a lot of people wrote about during the last 4 years, is that this is what happens in third world countries. It isn't, you know, but France isn't a third world country. Neither is Brazil. And so it's very frightening. It is what J.D. Vance's speech was. I mean, look what happened. He was making reference to Romania in his speech. If the elites, the elites in every country are trying to do the same things, they don't want to have a speech that they don't agree with. They don't want opposition. They don't want opposition candidates, and they want to solidify their power using the tools of and levers of government to ensure they don't, that their opponents are literally put in jail or thrown off the ballot. And so I think it's very frightening, and I think that that is why J.D. Vance gave that speech in Europe, and it is exactly why we need to be extremely concerned about making sure that it doesn't happen in our country ever again. And certainly that we should look and call out when it happens in other countries. Those are not democratic small d principles, and we should be willing and able to call it out. And I was very proud of the vice president for going directly to the European conference and telling those leaders to their faces, you are not upholding democratic principles, and we're not happy about that, and we think you should stop that. And of course they were traumatized, but the elites don't like it when people tell them not everybody likes what you're doing.
Yeah, they just want the outcome that they prefer, however they have to get there. And so it's not a rule of law type of nation. It's just a rule by power. And that's all that they care about. And He was absolutely right to call them out, and hopefully that will get resolved in France. But in the last 2 minutes that I have with you, Cleta Mitchell, and I really appreciate your time and describing kind of where we're at, how can people who are still very interested in this issue, if election integrity isn't on their ballot necessarily right now, like it was this week in Wisconsin, how can they get involved to ensure that maybe some of these measures are on the ballot in 2026 in their states and get involved tangibly in the efforts for free and fair elections?
If people will go to our website, it's the website of the Election Integrity Network, and it is whoscounting.us. That's W-H-O-S, whoscounting.us. We're in the process of upgrading our website, and we'll have a new website in the next month or so. But if you go and sign up there, we can direct you to, we have national working groups that are done by Zoom, so that you can be trained on different issues and principles, whatever you're interested in, whether it's voter rolls, or whether it is making sure that only citizens vote. But we have 10 national working groups on different topics, and we have state coalitions in about half the state, And so depending on your interest, if you would like to participate, and we need all the help we can get, and making changes in the election statutes, in the election procedures, and just people being involved in the election process, just go to whoscounting.us and sign up, and we will circle back and get in touch with you and find out your interests and help you learn what you can do to help. And then, as I said, if you want to learn about the principles that we think should be enshrined in law to ensure permanent election integrity, go to www.votefair2026.com. Look at those, and then we're going to have working groups on each of those principles, and would love to have as many people as we can possibly get to participate. That's the only way we'll ever overcome these elites who want to stop us at every turn.
Well, Cleta Mitchell, thank you so much for your breakdown of all of this for your election integrity efforts. And I know that this is a topic that our listeners are very passionate about and really want to ensure that as we move forward into 2026, 2028, and beyond, that we keep American elections safe and secure. So as always, if you have a topic or an issue that you would like us to discuss or guests you want to hear from, often we get a lot of requests and ideas from our listeners. You can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net, and make sure that you tune in every Friday for On Demand, and also every weekday morning from 7 to 8 Central and 8 to 9 Eastern for Jenna Ellis in the Morning, the live radio show where we break down the news of the day from a biblical worldview.